This episode of the New Christendom Daily is taken from a live radio broadcast. There's no scripts. There's no do-overs. There's no cuts. It's just from a live radio show done by a guy with a microphone and a set of earbuds and a radio show who pours his heart, his mind, and his body and soul into one thing, bringing about the New Christendom Daily. So I had the Marshall McLuhan interview that he gave in 1978. There's a couple of parts of this that I think go right along with this particular subject.
And this has become the main business of mankind, just watching the other guy.
And invading privacy.
Invading privacy, in fact, just ignoring it. Everybody has become porous. They got the light and the messages go right through us. As, by the way, at this moment,
right,
we are on the air, and we do not have any physical
this
body.
This is really good.
When you're on the telephone or on radio or on TV, you don't have a physical body. You're just an image on the air. When you don't have a physical body, you're a discarnate being. You have a very different relation to the world around you. And this, I think, has been one of the big effects of the electric age. It has deprived people, really, of their private identity.
So that's what this is doing to me?
Yes. Everybody tends to merge his identity with other people at the speed of light. It's called being mass man. It began, say, quite a long time ago.
God, save us. New technology, you say, is a revolutionizing agent.
Yes, it creates new situations to which people have very little time to adjust. They become alienated from themselves very quickly. And then they seek all sorts of bizarre outlets to establish some sort of identity by put-ons. Show business has become one way of establishing identity by just put-ons. And without the put-on, you're nobody.
This is profound stuff here.
And so people are learning show business as an ordinary daily way of survival. It's called role-playing. Role-playing has become the normal mode of survival in the business world.
So I'm going to stop right there. The first point just blew my mind. This interview was in 1978, by the way. This is I sat there staring at the audio waveform editor, stunned. When I am on air here on the Crusade Channel, when I was previously on air at SiriusXM and the Patriot Channel, when I was previously on air at Real Radio 95 in Lake Charles or WBT, 1110 in Charlotte, 610 WIOD, B97, WRBZ, and Ryan, the list could go on and on and on. I wasn't really there. My voice was coming through this thing called a speaker, through this thing called a radio, or now today, through a smartphone or a Bluetooth connection or whatever the technology may be, but I was not there. McLuhan's point is, and I don't know if you realize just how profound that statement is. Look, please don't get me wrong. I don't know that there's anything that could be done about this. This may be a permanent part. This may be just be an mutated, not an evolution. It's a mutation, if you will, of man. But I think that he's right, that once man had to adjust to the fact that almost everyone that he knows, that he comes in contact with in his daily life, is not really there. Dude, that's, as they say in the biz, that's a game changer. That means when you're on Twitter, and you're having an argument with someone or an agreement, you're going like, cheering someone on or whatever. They're not really there, and neither are you. It is an electronic, it isn't therefore, they literally are. They're not the Holy Ghost. They're a secular, they're a Geist in the German. But God made us to be to confront man, to be... Mano y mano, as they say. You're in the same room that I'm in the same room as. Hey, how are you? We're going to shake hands. We're going to do some bourbon shots. Yesterday was National Bourbon Day. You could do bourbon shots yesterday. It'd be great to do them together. But McLuhan's point is just profound, that well, this is a change in human relations here that seems to be permanent now, and there doesn't seem to be any reversing it. So man has now had to adjust, and now our relations and our relationships are now basically spiritual. Which is why I think this AI stuff is just, this is the next mutation. The AI and the deepfake and all that, that's the next mutation. That's why this godforsaken thing that Apple has come out with, I believe if Steve Jobs were alive, that project would have been killed in its infancy. That Apple Vision contraption. That is just sinister. You might as well be summoning up, if you're Jewish, a golem. You are saying to the cloud and to Apple Computing that you are okay with them making a deep fake facsimile of you and profiting from it. There's just something that's wrong with that. I don't know what it is, but it's just wrong. To quote Christopher Walken, it's all wrong. It's the wrong tone. You're talking to me, you're making a deep fake copy, it's all wrong. It is all wrong. Let me play you the next clip from McLuhan from this interview. It's going up on Crusade Max later today. Our children are becoming third world. Listen to this.
So what is happening to our own children is we're watching them become third world.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that they feel much more groupy and trendy than they do private or goal-oriented.
I see.
And so the disc jockeys helped this along in a huge way. And there's all the nostalgia. By the way, one of the big marks of the loss of identity is nostalgia. And so revivals on all hands.
Stop the tape! Charles Coulomb gave a wonderful talk 4 years ago at the St. Benedict Center Conference. Brother Andre, if you're listening, tell Brother Joseph Mayer he should put this up on the front page of their website to remind people about it, because Mike Church was talking about it on the radio today. It was all about nostalgia, and this is what Sir Charles said. Why nostalgia? Because we know something is missing. We've gotten rid of something that was good, true, and beautiful. Nostalgia is not, people think they go, oh, so nostalgic, I just love, people think that nostalgia is a good thing. It's not a good thing. Nostalgia, basically, if you're waxing nostalgic, you're basically saying, we killed something in the past that was good, and I want it back. I wish someone would make, we need to bring that back. This is what McLuhan is talking about here.
And so revivals on all hands in every phase of life today. Revivals of clothing, of dances, of music, of shows, of everything. We live by the revival. It tells us who we are.
Hammer time!
Now these children that are more groupy and less private, are they also more passionate or more violent?
I think that the sheer dislocation of their lives has put them through a very violent course indeed. They have been ripped off.
But they're kind of rudderless.
They don't have goals.
Don't have goals.
Listen.
Because at the speed of light, what is a goal? You're already there. You name it, and you're there.
Some of you may be going, oh, I don't see what the big deal is. Get back to bashing O'Biden. Didn't we do enough of that? Let's do some contemplative big boy undie and big girl panty stuff, shall we? Instead of complaining about it like some of you probably are pettifogging on it at crusadechannel.com/chat. Somebody go in the chat room and defend me, please. I want to go back to with the previous comment from McLuhan where he said that show business caters to it. This is so true. How many of you say you're a fan? Oh, I'm a fan of. Yeah, that's right. Aren't you a fan of the Bee Gees? Yes. Why? Well, according to McLuhan, because that gives me an identity. I used to have one before electronic media. I would had to have had an identity. Yeah, he's the weird kid down the street. He's the skinny kid with all the zits on his forehead. That was your identity. Now he's, yeah, he's the, what do they call him, Maggie? What are the goths? What do they call emos? With all the black fingernails and all that. Is that emos?
I grew up with goths.
Okay, well, he's a goth kid down the street. Yeah, he's always, you know, he's got his Metallica t-shirts and his, whatever. show business, and you heard him say role play. Why? Because it creates role playing. What have we said in advertisements about our congresses? Don't come to the Congress thinking that we're going to LARP, that we're going to live action role play, 13th, 14th century Christians. That's not what we're doing here. This is in 1978, McLuhan is talking about role-playing through show business. And by the way, I just want to comment briefly on what he said about violence, about, we have violently ripped them away from childhood. Maybe this also goes a little bit of the way to explaining why so many mass murderers. Why so much violence being done to children today, by children? Not that kids haven't always been mean and little devious little monsters, because they have, but not like this. Then here's another profound one from Marshall McLuhan, 1978 interview. We've been talking about how, you know, we have gone from the enchanted world of the miracles of St. Anthony of Lisbon, his brother Andrew, you call him St. Anthony of Padua. St. Anthony of Lisbon, his brother Andre told us yesterday. The enchanted world where miracles could happen. The enchanted world where men might have had heard, someone may have read to them, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. And, you know, how did people live in a world with these things that Sir Charles Coulomb calls them Arthurian legends? And Charles Coulomb will light a room up and will wax on for hours if you let him about Arthurian legends. Well, what's an Arthurian legend? Was there actually ever a King Arthur? Probably not. King Arthur, it is believed, is a composite of several kings and noblemen and knights. Were there knights of the Round Table? Well, I mean, not exactly as Chaucer or as they're depicted in Canterbury Tales. But yes, the Knights Templar. The Knights of St. John, there's so many orders here. This is an age that was not a literary age. People weren't running around and buying books. And if they did, the family probably had a couple of books, few books, because they were handmade until Gutenberg comes along. Almost all storytelling, we know that the story of Beowulf was never written down. It was passed on orally, which is why there are different versions of it. A great book that you might have found in the 13th century, but you wouldn't have had a copy of it, someone may have had a copy of it, would have been Dante's Inferno, for example, which is why it was so widely heard. People think it was read. It wasn't read. It was read aloud. That all changed with Gutenberg, and that all changed with the literary world when, as we talked about yesterday, when newspapers, for example, came along, and then even newspapers got too hard to read. That's too long. And then somebody started printing pamphlets. We live in a world today where pettifogging is an actual sport. It's a blood sport. Why? Because it's a literary age. Why is that? Well, people read a lot. Do they actually read a lot? Or did he just read a lot of crap? I read that story. Did you actually read? Now, I think this is important because Marshall McLuhan makes the point that propaganda you could have tried to propagandize someone in the 15th century, and it wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't have worked. You could not have had a Hitler. You could not have had a advertising agency for the cigarettes and whatever. You could not have had Hollywood doing to masses of people what was so easily done in the 21st or in the 20th and now the 21st century. Why? Because we're literary people. Here's McLuhan on, all right, why is propaganda, why does it work today? Because you're a literary people.
The violence of the media, you say, itself, invading those not prepared for it. It's not the content that's primary, it's this invasion of privacy that people are not prepared for that is destructive.
Recently had this trial of the young man who appealed to Kojak right. as his alibi for murder. This is a pathetic thing because nobody. However, literacy also, though, makes us very accessible to ideas and propaganda. The literate man is the natural sucker for propaganda. You cannot propagandize a native. You can sell him rum and trinkets, but you cannot sell him ideas. Therefore, propaganda is our Achilles heel. It's our weak point. We will buy anything if it's got a good hard sell tied to it. And so propaganda is the great big soft spot in the makeup of the literate man.
We'll buy anything if it's got a good tagline. Is that true? How many things have you bought because the bumper sticker, the cliche, or the slogan? Tastes great, less filling. Tastes great, less filling. But you're the native, the illiterate guy, you can't do that to him. He doesn't have the words. He doesn't have the vocabulary. He doesn't know what you're talking about. Profound stuff here. Here's another one. Electronic. Okay, what has the electronic age done? Now, everyone wants to blame Vatican II for the slide of the church, of the Catholic Church, if you're a Catholic. Okay, I think that there's plenty of blame for that to go around. But McLuhan doesn't take the bait. McLuhan says, no, there's something else that's going on here.
Electronic people, you say, lose their religion very easily.
Well, their attention span is very weak, as you know. We have invented the one-liner in place of the joke, because people can't wait around to hear you tell a joke. It takes too long. As for critics, said to Sam Goldwyn, don't even ignore them. That's a one-liner. That's all we have time for. There was a wonderful one-liner in the Morning Smile the other day. The teacher asked, what somebody defined for me nothing. And a child put his hand up at once and said, teacher, when you peel a balloon, what you have left is nothing. That's a one-liner. It's all we have time for. Attention span gets very weak at the speed of light. And that goes along with a very weak identity.
And religion, which involves ideas, requires a little more time.
Well, religion is a form of indoctrination which requires a considerable amount of literacy. Mm-hmm. You cannot get religion into people minus literacy. And as literacy weakens, people lose their religious affiliations.
You've written to or been quoted as saying something to do with criminals in jail who have watched endless hours of television. Was that a put on?
No, that's a little mixed up. What I was referring to was a recent study made in Colorado of the boys behind bars. And the discovery was that every one of them is a dyslexic.
This is behind prison bars?
Yes, in penitentiaries in Colorado. Mm-hmm. 100% dyslexic. That is, people with learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. And this happens in our world. There have been studies here in Toronto and in Canada of the same phenomenon. And the strange thing is that 9 out of 10 dyslexic or 9 out of 10 learning disability people are boys. Only 1 in 10 is a girl.
But what's the relationship with television or watching television?
Well, TV has a strange effect on the eye muscles. It tends to paralyze or to hypnotize the motor muscles of the eyes, so that the much television viewing person tends to have a very poor ability to move his eyes on the print over across the printed word or on the printed page, and he needs exercises to correct this, and the exercises need to be taken quite early while he's in his early years, because otherwise they harden. But the ideal exercise for this purpose is the trampoline.
trampoline.
Loosening up the eye muscles. But now, the reason that boys are so prone to this problem and girls are not is that the exercises that boys take, hockey and baseball and football, these exercises are very crude and muscularly and do not help the eye muscles in the reading activity. Whereas skipping and sewing and cosmetics and so on give the girls a much more delicate muscular coordination than boys. And they have less learning disability.
I see.
Who thinks of this stuff? So take your sewing kits and needles away from the little girls and you're removing a motor and eye-hand coordination skill that actually may be undoing some of the damage that's done to them by watching screens all day long. Now let me just add one more point to this. McLuhan probably didn't know, and he couldn't have known, he probably wouldn't have known back in 1978. How many of you people know what a refresh rate is? Megan, do you know what a refresh rate is? You do. Okay, well, it used to be on old CRT, that's cathode ray tube, CRT monitors, you could calibrate and set the monitor, and you could change what's called the refresh rate. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, because you might get a headache from staring at a CRT monitor for too long if it has a very fast refresh rate. How many of you are familiar with how our fluorescent light works? Well, a fluorescent light works because it has a refresh rate, which is why some people cannot be in rooms long term with only fluorescent light, because you can't see it with the naked eye. But if you had a super, super slow motion camera, you could film it. That fluorescent light is actually vibrating. It's turning on, turning off in milliseconds. You can't see it, but that's what it's doing. Well, your eye can see it and your brain can pick it up. And some people pick it up too much and they get headaches. You'll get a headache from being in a room with a fluorescent light. Same thing with a CRT.
120 cycles per second.
Go ahead. Yes, please add.
I said fluorescent lights flicker 120 cycles per second.
Okay, so a computer screen used to be between 65 and 85 cycles per second. What does that mean? Well, how does something move on a CRT tube? It gives you the illusion that it's moving. Well, it's moving because of the refresh rate. So it's showing you the image at the beginning of the second, and then 75 times during that second, if you got a 75 kilohertz or 75,000 times, okay, that's what a kilohertz would be. A 70 or a hertz would be 750 times a second. This is how you get the illusion of movement. But note, it is an illusion. It is the illusion of movement, which is what a motion picture does. Used to be when we had film projection and everyone was going to movies and they weren't digitized, what was the projector doing? It was opening and closing. High definition opening and closing 29 times a second. Used to be 24 frames, then it changed to 29. 29 times, well, the digital refresh is 29 times per second. The point of this is when this is introduced, man has to mutate to accommodate this stuff. There is no doubt, there can be no doubt, we believe that vaccinations have a lot to do with this as well, that it is boys. Note that McLuhan was focusing in on boys. I mean, just boys that are suffering dyslexia. Boy, what would you give, those of you that are parents or kids on the autism scale, what would you give to have your son trait his autism, especially at a high, testing high on the autism scale, for just good old-fashioned dyslexia. And as McLuhan said, well, there are ways, you know, you can actually treat dyslexia, but you know, you got to know what you're doing. It is undeniable that boys have been assailed by modernity. Modernity has killed the young male. It's trying to finish the job off. That's part of a demonic plan. But how has it done it? And this is something that no one is actually looking at. Well, if you listen to Marshall McLuhan here, everyone wants to just point at the vaccination schedule. And I'm not giving it a pass because I think it has something to do with it, the MMR vaccination pass. But if you're listening to what McLuhan was saying, you know, boys aren't out there doing those. They are out there playing hockey and they are out there playing baseball. They're not out there doing those things that would undo the damage that is being done by the CRT tube, which we don't have anymore. Now we have LED. Listen to the whole interview, all 28 minutes of it. I'll post it later on today at crusademax.com. Now, finally here, how did he, because you may think, that guy, he's a product of, no, he's not, he's a convert to the faith. How did that happen? Listen.
Describe your conversion to Roman Catholicism in 1938 as a long pilgrimage and a solitary one, done entirely by reading.
That's, I think, true. Except, again, that I had luck. I met people, too. Mm-hmm. But it was mainly a literary activity.
A book by Gilbert Keith Chesterton, What's Wrong with the World?
Yes. Yep.
Handed to me on a Winnipeg street by Tom Easterbrook. He said to me, I hated this book. I think you'll like it.
I've often wondered, you know, I read some Chesterton myself in my younger days. And I've often wondered if you'd be satisfied with your contribution on a much more global scale than Chesterton's, but seeing being something similar to his. He was always taking the accepted and turning it upside down and inside out.
Having a good look at it from many sides. He was cubist, you see. A paradox is a form of cubism in which you look at the same situation simultaneously from different directions.
And so there are some parallels there.
Oh, well, sure. The habit of a discontinuous and multi-leveled perception. But it goes partly also with my interest in Joyce Pound Elliott, because right. they are also multifaceted people and very right hemisphere people. But the...
And Harold Innes.
Harold Innes, I was very lucky to encounter him. It was through The Mechanical Bride that I met him, and when I heard that he had put it on his reading list, I was fascinated to find out what sort of an academic would put a book like The Mechanical Bride on a reading list. So that's how I went around and met him, and we became.
All right, so McLuhan comes to the faith because of What's Wrong with the World, Chesterton's work, which we have in the Founders Trading Post store at shop.mikechurch.com. I found it, just listen to the whole interview, because this guy, we need Marshall McLuhan's today to just look at what it is that's going on and not bitch about it. Instead, analyze it and go like, well, okay, well, I think this is what is happening here. And I think that this is very not good for us. This is very dangerous and not good for us. I wonder what he would say. McLuhan died in 1981, so I wonder what he would say if he were alive today and he would say, okay, this is a new thing called Pride Book by this company called Meta. Go hang out on this Meta thing. We set you an account up. Go hang out on the Meta for a couple hours today. We're going to come back and interview you. I just wonder what a genius, what a brilliant mind like that, who, by the way, as Brother Andre says, looking at the world through a Christian view, which I believe is what Chesterton was doing. That was his gift. Now, when he says that Chesterton was a cubist, I've always heard it said that Chesterton was a master of the, it's not a catch-22, but it basically is, was a master of the paradox. That, you know, you give the challenge of something, and then you give the answer to it, and then you give the challenge. You know, it's almost like Jeopardy. You do it in reverse, right? But McLuhan called Chesterton a cubist, which is to take any one thing. So let's say we were to take social programming, not media, social programming, and you look at it from this lens, from this point of view, and you go like, wait a minute, but someone else is looking at it from a user point of view, or this is how they live their life. Let's go on to the other side of the cube, and let's go look at it from that point of view. And then you see that, well, okay, well, this thing is looked at so differently. Now, you just play the game with me for a second here. Let's introduce an apple to this. What can you do with an apple? Well, Maggie can think of all kinds of things to do with an apple. You can just rinse it in a little water and eat it straight up. You don't need to cut it. You could cut it, though, couldn't you? You could cut it into slices. You could cover it with peanut butter or caramel or chocolate or what's that stuff that they make candy apples out of, sugar. You can stick a popsicle stick in it to do that, but it's still an apple. It's only changed its form. The substance of the apple is still there, isn't it? You could cut it into slices, throw it into a ninja and pulverize it into paste, into mush, and then make an applesauce with it. You could cut it into smaller pieces and boil it and then make an apple pie out of it. But at the end of the day, it's only changed its form. Its substance is still an apple. I think this is important. Well, can anyone explain to me what is the substance of a Facebook? I think this is truly the issue here. Does Facebook have a substance? Does Twitter have a substance? Now, social programming, you may say, well, it kind of has a nature. Does it really? Because it's very not natural. So, but does it have a substance? I don't think it does. I think it's substanceless, which is a problem, which means anything can be inserted into it, and anyone can be programmed using it to do anything. Is that what we're witnessing? I think that is exactly what we're witnessing. Does it have a form? Does social programming have a form? These are serious, serious. Is anyone going to talk about this? I think this is the fact that, and I don't know how we stumbled on, I know how we stumbled on, because reading Rod Dreher, the Dreher stumbled on Marshall McLuhan. You know, then I had people emailing me, telling me, dude, when I was back in college in the 70s, McLuhan was like mandatory read. We had to read him. You know, it was a required reading.